Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Shallow Dive, coming to you from City University. I'm Alex Wagard.
And I'm Murray Jones.
And we are here once again to guide you through a turbulent week of politics. We're going to talk immigration, we're going to talk democratic debate, we're going to talk special convicted criminals in Venezuelan police forces. We've got it all.
Indeed we have.
Yeah.
And we're sitting in sort of an epicentre of a smaller political struggle going on at the moment.
Yep.
There are strikes going on amongst City University, but also all of the UCU, which stands for
University and Colleges Union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lecturers and tutors are striking on a multiple number of issues, but I think the most pressing from our point of view is the sort of casualisation of university work and teaching. Yeah. So rather than it being a full-time job, people are hired on a more, so almost like a freelance basis, just to do the hours that they're in a classroom, which of course doesn't lead to the best kind of teaching.
And the other issue is their pensions are being dramatically reduced from a defined benefit model to a defined contribution model. Getting weedly already.
Yeah, you made it exciting in the intro there, Alex.
Really going to draw them into listening to the...
But the wider interesting issue is the kind of devaluing of a university degree, which is, you know, more and more people are going to university, more and more people are getting higher grades. There's kind of courses in academic subjects that aren't necessarily academic that are being sort of academized unnecessarily. And students are very much being treated more as customers than they are as students.
Indeed.
So there's a lot of big issues going on there at the moment. And we're bloody missing our lectures as well.
But the good news
is we're the victims here.
We have more time to podcast.
So here it is.
Without further ado,
episode 4.
Our first segment will be on immigration.
Here we go. And we start with a huge UK government policy announcement. There is finally a new, brand shiny new immigration system based on points. So your entry into this country is finally a bit like a game show. And if you get enough points, you're allowed in. Am I understanding that right, Alex?
Roughly, I think, yeah.
Okay, let's move on then.
No, so the government's immigration proposals are that what the government defines as low-skilled workers will not get visas. There will be no more caps on the number of skilled workers allowed in, and EU and non-EU workers are to be treated equally. So yes, it's going to be a points-based system, which means so various attributes that the worker might or might not have will give them points. And if they reach 70 points, what do points mean?
Prizes!
Yeah, no. If you get 70 points, the prize is that you will be allowed into the UK. So, for example, a job offer will give you 20 points. A job at an appropriate skill level will give you another 20 points. If you're English speaking, that will give you 10 points. And if you have a relevant PhD in a STEM subject, that will give you 20 points.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also some salary criteria as well, right?
Yes. So the salary threshold will vary between £20,000 and £30,000 a year, depending on whether it's a sector with a labour shortage. So if there aren't very many workers in that sector, then the salary threshold will be lower.
Nursing and social care were the ones sort of highlighted for particularly for that policy.
Yeah. Weren't they? So the Economist's line is that an English-speaking ballerina with a STEM PhD will do very, very well.
Well, that's great for the arts then. Finally, some good news for the arts.
The PhD holding arts.
Not so great for the very large elderly population who need people to care for them.
Yeah. So just to compare this with the current system currently in the UK, anybody in the EU and broader European economic area have the automatic right to live and work in the UK if they want to, and they can claim benefits if they're economically active.
Mm-hmm. And that's ending December 31st, currently.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So this is going to be a massive change in the way that EU and non-EU workers are going to be treated equally, and generally the threshold is going to be higher.
So onto a bit more analysis of what this means. So the whole area of equality amongst EU and non-EU citizens, you know, that's generally quite a good thing. But obviously it's prejudicial and discriminatory against lower skilled or even just lower wage workers. Right?
Yeah. I mean, well, so the distinction is always between low skilled and high skilled workers. Obviously, that's disputed by migration activists who would say that a lot of these people are very highly skilled, they work extremely hard.
Yeah, it's just low paid,
exactly.
Low wage jobs.
Which is defined by how much the market needs those jobs rather than how highly skilled they are.
Yeah, or how many people are able to do them.
Yeah, but so, you know, this is why university wages are so low, for example, is because there's a massive surplus of people with PhDs.
Yeah.
It's not that university workers are low skilled, they're some of the highest skilled people in the general population. It's just that there are too many of them and that pushes wages down.
Mm.
So industry groups have spoken out against this.
Yeah, it's quite dangerous for car manufacturers.
Yep.
Who are already worried about the implications of Brexit. They're one of the industries that's going to be hit hardest by extra potential tariffs and loss of custom from European markets and things like that.
Yeah. And also, as you mentioned earlier, adult social care. There's already a huge funding problem in the industry. And the current model is dependent on low-wage labour.
Yeah.
So if they have to pay more for their labour, it's going to be huge.
Yeah, and it's roughly nearly 20% of social care workers are foreign-born.
Yeah.
So that's a huge, huge market.
And there's already 1 out of 11 posts in the industry are unfilled.
Right.
So pretty bad.
Yeah. So for an area already in crisis for so many reasons, it's adding more strain onto it, which is a bit of a recipe for disaster, it seems. But the government are being quite resilient about this. They're not saying, oh, you know, we'll make it work for your business. They're saying, you have to adapt.
Yeah.
You have to sort this out. This is the new reality. This is what people want. This is the future. Get used to it, basically.
Yeah.
Being quite bullish about it. Which, what do you think for a Conservative government to be so sort of bullish against business concerns?
It's interesting. I mean, so the Conservative movement, whichever country you're in, is always kind of a weird marriage between culturally conservative people and libertarian-minded people.
Mm.
So, you know, for the past few decades, the Conservative Party in the UK has mainly been pro-business, which is the libertarian wing winning out.
Yeah.
And the new government, I think, is, you know, intimating that it's going more for the cultural conservatives.
Yeah, a bit protectionist.
Yeah, and it's an interesting question whether it's going to work out politically. What do you think? Is it going
to
work?
Well, I think it's galvanising to the sort of the core Brexit voters, the Leave voters, right? That was undeniably, I think, however people tried to paint it, a big issue when it came to the EU referendum.
Yeah.
Was this idea of taking back control, particularly of the borders and immigration.
Mm.
And there's varying perceptions amongst voters of what immigration truly, the level it was truly at and the effect it truly had.
Yeah.
But I think there was a general consensus that it was uncontrolled to an extent that wasn't desirable for lots of people. This was within the Leave voting cohort.
Yeah.
And I think, so politically, I think that very much delivers what these people want. They claim it's similar to an Australian points-based system, which is Nigel Farage has been proposing that idea for about 20 years. What used to be a fringe Farage talking point is now solid UK government policy with a majority. So I think that shows the journey we've had politically over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's interesting, though, because the Brexit vote was highest in areas with lower immigration levels.
Mm.
So it's a question of whether it's actually the immigration itself that's driving this political trend or whether it's the perception of changing culture, changing country that's driving it. And, you know, those two are very different things. And the whole Australian style thing has famously, you know, sort of come out of focus groups by Cummings and Farage, and, you know, was repeated so incessantly because people hear Australia and they think white people. So they hear Australian style points-based immigration system and they think that's going to make the UK a whiter place. But actually, by equalising the threshold for EU and non-EU workers to come into the country, that actually might make migrants into the UK more diverse. Might mean we have more Asian immigrants, more highly skilled workers from India, for example. We'll find it easier to come in. So, yeah, I don't know. You know, when people hear about these proposals, they might think, oh, yes, you know, that's great. You know, go back to the way it was, going to become less diverse. But that might not actually happen, even if migration levels are cut slightly.
I'm not sure. I think the whole sort of diversity part of it is less of a concern. I think it was largely economic concerns that drove the worries about immigration. Too many people in a labour market was pushing wages down or keeping them lower. Or again, that was the perception. And I think in certain towns, you did have large amounts of people come in quite a short space of time, maybe. And it was different countries in different times, but early on it was Poland. And a lot of Polish people did come over and start working in construction and things like that. And for the people that worked in construction who were finding it harder to get a job or were finding it harder to get a good wage, I think that cemented anti-immigration feeling in a lot of towns around the country where that happened. And I don't think there's so much a worry about diversity or the idea of Polish culture taking over. It was just a very literate, outsiders have changed the situation in a way that's not beneficial to me. I don't think they actually, there's a dislike of the people and their background. I think it's just their dislike of outsiders kind of motivation.
So I have some economic analysis for you.
So
the UK and the changing Europe thinks that this will cut overall net migration by 35,000, and it's currently at 212,000. So that's a significant cut, but not a huge cut.
Mm-hmm.
And work by the government's own Migration Advisory Committee found that new rules would slightly reduce overall GDP, but marginally increase GDP per head. So that means it will, you know, for people currently in the UK, they will feel better off, probably because wages will rise a little because there are more labour shortages. And The Economist's analysis says, that's the magazine, says that fewer unskilled workers might put some upward pressure on wages, but that the minimum wage has much more effect on that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there might be significant regional problems in that skilled workers often earn more down south than up north. And obviously, there are a lot of northern constituencies that voted for Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
The new rules might mean that it's much easier for businesses to locate down south than up north, because they'll be able to attract workers if they employ them at southern salary rates than at northern salary rates, if that makes sense.
I can see what you mean, but couldn't the companies in the north just offer those salaries where they are?
Maybe. I'm just putting forward a criticism that's been raised. So, you know, if it worsens regional inequality between the UK's north and south, then that will obviously annoy a lot of the people who voted for Brexit.
True, true. I'm interested as well on what you think about the wider principle that the UK is becoming a more closed-off country, that this idea of a welcoming multicultural hub. It's like we're trying to turn away from that now. This policy is a signal to the rest of the world that unless you're pretty wealthy or pretty skilled, we're not interested in having you. Does that damage our reputation? Do we look more xenophobic to the rest of the world now?
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting one. There's a tension in that. I think it's true that a political party should, you know, work in the interests of the people who it represents, right? So a political party in the UK should probably try to win votes by making things better for UK people,
mm-hmm.
right? But then there are two arguments for higher immigration levels. One's kind of a libertarian economic argument that, you know, higher immigration levels means higher GDP levels, good for the economy. And then the other argument for higher immigration levels is sort of a liberal internationalist moral which is, I think the reason why there's nobody really arguing strongly for higher immigration levels at the moment is neither of those arguments is one that the left in the UK really particularly wants to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
Because in order to win a majority, they're going to need to win back a lot of northern seats,
mm-hmm.
who are feeling quite culturally conservative, quite anti-immigration. And as an economically left party, they don't want to embrace the libertarian economic argument either.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like the left is strongest when they can make exactly the argument that you've made, right? When they can talk about hostile environment, when they can sort of point to, you know, moral outrages like the deportations to Jamaica recently.
Yeah.
But when it comes to sort of a dry economic argument, you know, has to kind of hedge and talk about, try and shift the subject to the hostile environment policy and things like that, I think, which is interesting.
Yeah, it is a difficult tension for the Labour Party. I wonder if the moral arguments will continue to be made by the leadership candidates now, or whether they are going to shift towards the more focus on the economic hardcore, you know. Is that the way to win back voters? Is that their strategy? I don't think Long Bailey is, you know, going to shift towards that. Keir Starmer's quite good at, he's quite an internationalist moral
I think Starmer's probably the most pro-immigration of them, isn't he?
Yeah, probably. Or is less willing to give that up for strategic gain.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I remember Ed Miliband had this big tension back in 2015.
Mm.
And his solution was, I think it was something along the lines of construction companies would be incentivized to hire British workers first.
Yeah.
So rather than, it was sort of trying to placate one of the symptoms of immigration rather than lower immigration itself.
Yeah.
Which seemed like a somewhat elegant solution to pleasing both sides.
I mean, Stephen Bush has this line where you kind of can't say to voters, I hear you, but you're wrong.
Yeah.
You either have to kind of agree with them or admit that you're just not going to do what they want.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Ed Miliband did not win the election.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know?
Yeah.
And that seems to be like Lisa Nandy's basic idea as well, is to sort of, you know, talk about towns a lot and say, I hear your concerns, but then at the end of the day, come out in favour of freedom of movement. And those two things are fundamentally contradictory at the end of the day. You know, you can't say that we're listening to the concerns of people in towns incessantly and then disagree with everything that those people in towns are telling you.
Well, but she disputes that is what everyone in towns are telling her, and that's kind of painting a picture of some voters, but it's not true of all voters.
Well, her strategy is to say that those people are, you know, suffering, but then dispute that they're suffering for the reasons why they say they're suffering.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if that's ever going to be a vote-winning strategy. I mean, she might, if she becomes Labour leader, she might prove me wrong, but I'm just sceptical.
Mm. But then how far do you go down that line where if you do think that a significant number of people are wrongly blaming a group of people for their problems and is being stoked by prejudicial people who are taking advantage of it, at what point do you draw a line and go, you're just wrong about what you think the problem is, I'm afraid. And I can't placate that because it's unethical to do so.
Yeah, I mean, like, the liberal internationalist within me wants people to make the full-throated moral argument for higher immigration and say, you know, actually, this will make you more prosperous. You know, we need to think more about economic redistribution. We need to help these people in these places more.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, you are just wrong. And with that,
we're all just wrong. That's have a pause and think about that for a second.
Okay, and now on to lesser covered stories of the week. Murray, what have you got?
Well, call me a member of the Dead Kennedys because we're taking a holiday to Cambodia. So Prime Minister Hun Sen of Cambodia has caused a bit of international worry. There was a cruise ship, one of the lesser known sort of cruise ships that's going around at the moment with potential coronavirus patients and sufferers on it. And it was refused port at 5 different countries. Mm-hmm. Until Mr. Hun Sen said, come to Cambodia, we'll take you in. No problems.
Like a great idea.
He was thought to have been motivated mainly politically. One, to repair reputation with the US, because it seemed to be a humanitarian, altruistic act. One, to sort of blindside and get rid of the story about the EU cutting trade ties to a certain extent with them based on their lack of political freedom going on there.
Yep.
Also to improve or keep strong the relationships with China, which Cambodia massively, massively, massively depend on for their economic development.
Sure.
But what he did was he greeted all the people off. They didn't do a proper quarantine on the ship. He really, really insisted that no one wear face masks. He hugged all of the people coming off. He's encouraged, he's going to have a big party for them at some point. And there's a real concern that he is doing quite the opposite of quarantining. He is like letting people potentially with corona run free around Cambodia.
Good to hear. Great stuff, Cambodia.
Yeah.
Okay.
On to you, Alex. What you got?
So I've got a Reuters investigation that convicted criminals are among the special police in Venezuela. So, yeah. Seems great, right?
At least they know what they're doing.
Yeah. So this is the Special Action Force, which was founded by Maduro 2 years ago. There were big shortages in police numbers, so this group was founded. They've been accused of torture and summary executions by human rights groups, opposition politicians, and ordinary citizens. So, what do ordinary citizens know about the police? I mean,
very little.
Probably fine, you know. So they've been accused of a form of social control, and this in-depth Reuters report has shown that large numbers of the police force are made up of convicted criminals. Some have violent crimes, and they are not doing great.
Okay, so worrying for the people of Venezuela, as if they didn't have enough.
Exactly.
Going on at the moment.
They didn't have enough on their plate. So, how about you? What's your next one?
Oh, yeah, me next. So off to Canada now. Mm-hmm. Where there have been protests around the country, specifically in Edmonton, Alberta, and Ontario. So these are sort of the west and the east of the nation. And it is by the First Nations, which is the Indigenous people of Canada. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to get the pronunciation right. Wet'suwet'en. Wet'suwet'en. indigenous tribe who are protesting a natural gas pipeline that is going through northern British Columbia in their territory, and they are protesting by blocking railways and transports of goods and people. And it's caused a bit of a political crisis in Canada because Prime Minister Trudeau is very, you know, pro First Nations people. He's seen as an ally of them and paints himself as one. But this is them breaking the law, stopping, you know, economic goods moving about. The federal government don't recognize their claim to the land that they claim either. Mm-hmm. They never, they're one of the more, they never formally sold or agreed anything with the federal government historically to sell their land or to have reserves or anything like that. Yeah. So,
although even the ones that did sell their land often were kind of coerced into doing it.
Of course. But this tribe have never sort of formally come into agreements with the government anyway.
Yeah, of course,
so they're harder to deal with or kind of go back to any rules-based agreement. So, yeah.
It's quite a long-running tension, isn't it, between the Trudeau government and Indigenous people in Canada over the pipeline?
Yes, yeah. So the pipeline... well, this isn't the pipeline that's caused...
Oh, okay.
No, this is a different... a less important or politically...
A less covered pipeline.
Yes.
Great.
But now it's not. Now it's big national news as well because it's very much conservative, you know. These indigenous people are stopping us doing something. It's a very small minority of people stopping economic development, blah, blah, blah. You know what they're going to say. And some people are calling them for sending the army to take out, not take out, literally, remove peacefully these people who are there. But those on the other side obviously are aware of the historical tensions and everything. That whole picture with the indigenous population.
Sending in the army always makes things better.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a very sensitive issue and there's no clear and easy solution. But at the end of the day, the federal government do not agree that they have a claim to the land. The pipeline is approved and the indigenous people are blocking multiple railways criminally. So Trudeau has kind of nowhere to maneuver politically, I'd say. So that was a really interesting one. I hadn't read that at all in the British news.
Yeah.
But I guess they have to come to this podcast for that. What's your next one?
My next one is stretching the limits of the definition of lesser covered stories. So New York Times has been doing some fantastic investigative reporting over the past few months on the epidemic of child sexual abuse material online, which a lot of people might know as child pornography. Activists don't like that term, but yeah. And over the last 2 days, The Daily has just done two extraordinary podcasts based on their months-long investigation and the lack of proposed solutions into this problem. So there's just a massive epidemic of abuse material that's circulating online. The tech companies are doing very little to clamp down on it, and in fact, the problem might get even worse. There's much more of an emphasis on privacy these days. And as electronic communications become more and more private, it's going to become harder and harder for people to clamp down on this kind of material circulating online.
Right.
No, so it's just a really stunning piece of journalism. And I advise everybody to go and listen to those podcasts and read the Times' investigations over the last few months.
Okay.
How about you? For your next one. Now I've brought the tone to a much more serious place.
So this is in the country of Albania. A country I would highly recommend for anyone to visit. It's beautiful, much cheaper, and just as beautiful as Greece, just to the north of there. So recommended for anyone going on a holiday. But
that's why they come to this podcast. Holiday recommendations.
But their politics is not so calm and beautiful as their ocean. Their president...
Is any country's politics?
Their president, Ilia Meta... recommended that the people rise up against the government. Just to be clear, the president is separate from the governing party, who are the government, if that was somewhat implied by...
their title?
Yeah.
Sounds like a good idea, rising up.
He claims that the government are also doing their own coup by interfering through the justice system.
Okay.
So he's called on 3 million people to... which is the population of Albania, to turn up in the capital, Tirana, to protest these judicial reforms that they're putting through, something that we've touched on a podcast before. reforms were approved three years ago to root out bribery and to make prosecutors independent from politics, because Albania are really, really keen on becoming members of the EU. And that's a big precondition from the EU to be a potential member state. So the Socialist Party there, who were elected in recent elections, are putting these reforms through. However, this Meta guy, the president, considers their election illegitimate because there was a boycott from the other major party in that election. So the socialists sweeped up. I've never understood really the motivation for boycotting elections, because you're always guaranteeing that your opposition wins.
I think,
but that's another issue.
The election of legitimacy, usually.
True, but it also ensures that the people you don't want take power, but that's a debate for another day.
If you're an Albanian person in favour of boycotting,
do get in touch.
You have no contact details available.
But yeah, so he's called for a protest on March the 2nd, so we might come back in a few episodes' time and see what happened with those protests. I have no idea whether his concerns are very much shared by the people of Albania, or whether he's a bit of a rogue political actor who's actually probably, maybe he's worried that he's going to get done for corruption. Mm. It's hard to say at this point.
Great. I'm afraid I do not have a third story this week.
Unbelievable.
We're just going to leave it at that.
Yes.
On to our final segment.
Here we go. Okay, and here we go. Our fourth debate. Luckily for Alex, he is not going to be arguing the more libertarian side. He's getting a break from that. I'll be the Ayn Rand fan this week. And I will be defending billionaires. And not just them as people, but them as a sort of a concept or a figure in society. So our debate topic motion today will be Every Billionaire is a Policy Failure, which originated in the US with one of Ocasio-Cortez's aides came out with it. And it sort of became a bit of a viral phrase for a while. And I think it was bouncing around during the general election in the UK as well. So Alex will be making the case that every billionaire is a policy failure, and I will be telling him why he's obviously wrong. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, so here we go. So I stayed up for the Democratic debate last night, mm-hmm. a little bit of it. Didn't watch the whole thing because it was quite late. I needed to go to bed. But Michael Bloomberg was there, and what an atrocious performance it was. Mm. This just shows the out of touch level that billionaires are at. They just think they can buy the presidency of the United States, and that's just simply wrong. Billionaires have a disproportionate amount of influence in society. They are able to subvert and control democratic processes, and we need to clamp down on this immediately. There was also the announcement this week that Jeff Bezos intends to give $10 billion to charity to fight climate change. This is extremely welcome. But then you look at his net worth, $132 billion has Jeff Bezos. He is the richest man in the world. $10 billion is going to go a huge, long way. But just imagine how many problems we could solve in the world if he was giving away $100 billion instead. Nobody needs that amount of money. Nobody could spend that amount of money in a lifetime. It is ridiculous that someone would hoard that amount of wealth just purely for their own sense of ego. And that's really all it is. There's a huge number of problems we could solve in the world if we abolished billionaires. They're not nice people. Nobody likes them. They should get in the sea.
Wow. So it went from policy suggestion to death threats quite quickly.
Can be given buoyancy aids.
Well, how to respond for that? Well, I suppose the best way to describe your argument is pish. Absolute pish. So, yeah, this is the strange, twisted, relativist morals of the extreme left that you're spouting here, where a man voluntarily gives $10 billion to fight a global emergency, and somehow he's an immoral bastard and he's done the wrong thing. I don't know when the left became such spoilt children, where they can't accept where an altruistic person has done something great for the world. Overall, billionaires, you know, they didn't just arrive at this magically somewhere. They weren't ordained by God to be some kind of billionaire angel. They worked to get their billions, right? Through savvy business choices. If you had the capability, Alex, to make those choices, I'm sure you would pursue the path of being a billionaire. You're not stopping yourself being a billionaire out of some moral choice. Just like the vast majority of us, you are incapable of becoming a billionaire. And this idea to abolish billionaires is just the ultimate politics of resentment that doesn't actually solve societal problems at all. It just points the finger at a group which actually is contributing so much to solving some of the world's problems with their by voluntarily giving up their admittedly very large pool of resources. Yeah, I can't see where you're coming from at all.
Well, Murray, you know what? I am resentful. And you know why I'm resentful? Because people like you buy into the false myth of a meritocratic society. This country isn't meritocratic. This world isn't meritocratic. There's no way I could get my billions just by sitting in a podcast studio with you. There's no way I could get my billions even just through any career in journalism. Society doesn't give appropriate weight and appropriate value to careers that really matter to society. And it's an outrage that doctors and teachers and, well, frankly, journalists get paid so little, while footballers get paid vast sums of money for kicking a ball around a pitch. What impact does that have on people's lives? A lot, admittedly. Sport is important to society, but is it that important? I don't really think so. Numerous studies have shown that people get to incredibly high net worth, not through working hard, but through life circumstances, through being in the right place at the right time. This is a cruel, chaotic world in which luck matters a huge amount, and I'm just amazed to see these libertarian arguments that have been disproven time and time again come from you, Murray. I thought you were better than that.
Well, Alex, I hate to break this news to you at such a young age, but you need to hear this, that life isn't fair. You can't get billions just by sitting in a studio indulging yourself talking about politics. It's not how the world works. And while I am against the sort of hereditary transfer of wealth between generations, I would suggest that the billionaires that exist in the world, particularly in the Western world, have become billionaires because they have been innovators in their sectors. Elon Musk, incredible innovator. Jeff Bezos, incredible innovator. Look at the way Amazon has shaped and changed people's lives. The convenience that retail has come across, and the low cost that so many goods are affordable now because of his innovations. Bill Gates, I mean, the foundation of mass computer software. So the idea that people who own billions haven't contributed, it's just bad logic. It's just false. And these people, they're innovators. They start their own companies. These companies earn huge amounts of money because people are willing to pay for the products that they produce. There's no big con here. They're not conning anyone. People pay and give them the money collectively, and they collect it as billions because they're the one person or the one company that created such an innovation. That sounds like fairness to me. People agree to buy their products and they receive the money. What's unfair about that?
Well, it's a beautiful straw man argument, Murray, but I'm afraid that I'm not suggesting that these people haven't contributed to society.
That's what you said.
I'm suggesting that these people haven't contributed to society enough to be worth $132 billion. Undoubtedly, Jeff Bezos has revolutionized the way the e-commerce sector and changed, consigned hundreds of high street shops to decline and death. And I'm sure, that's worth a lot of money. But is it worth $132 billion? I don't think so. I'm saying that the
well, you don't get to decide that,
can
Alex.
Can you let me finish, Murray?
Because you don't get to decide that.
But I'm saying the market has failed and the government needs to step in, is what I'm saying. These people deserve money. Maybe they deserve a lot of money. But the extent to which this is happening now is insane. And you look at, you say somebody like Jeff Bezos contributed a huge amount to society. And I would say the hundreds of thousands of workers in awful working conditions in Amazon warehouses would have a lot to say about that, you know?
What would they say?
Bad things. Very bad things. So, yeah, you're wrong.
Shall I take that as your closing argument?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, well, Alex, I agree that there's problems with income inequality in this country and in the US and, of course, all around the world. But the targeting specifically of billionaires, I think, is just populism, basically. Dangerous populism. We kind of victimize this small group of people. And I'm not going, oh, poor billionaires, people don't like them. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's bad politics, it's bad logic, it's bad policy to target the elimination of billionaires when these are just people that have innovated in a sector and have got millions of people, maybe billions, to buy their products, right? Voluntarily give them money for the thing they made, right? It's the basics, business 101, right? And so I don't think that's unjust or unfair. I think they should be taxed hugely. But the idea that individual people who are billionaires through owning large companies be the mirth of society is just faulty logic and playing to the crowd and basic populism that's not going to get us anywhere.
Just a few rejoinders to that.
That was my closing statement. Go on, be quick.
I mean, it's not as if we didn't have any innovation before we entered the sort of second gilded age that we're in now. You know, there were innovations prior to the invention of billionaires. I think we should reward people who innovate. We should reward them a lot, but it's just the sheer extent to which we're at now that is causing problems. And also, you talked about inequality, and I'm glad you did, because there have been several studies that show that social mobility is in fact linked to inequality. So as a great advocate of meritocracy yourself, Murray, I think you should be in favour of lessening inequality in order to promote social mobility, frankly.
But I think the best way to lower inequality is by boosting the wages of those at the bottom, not targeting billionaires.
And what way to give them a larger slice of the pie than simple wealth redistribution?
Well, like I said, I'm very, very in favour for higher taxes, wealth redistribution.
And on that,
I just think the elimination of billionaires is a silly idea.
And on that note of agreement. All right, and now to close off the episode, we thought we would have a little lighter story, a little bit on the Democratic debate last night.
Yes, the claws were out last night. They finally really started having a go at each other.
Okay, the absolute roasting of Michael Bloomberg by everybody.
Finally.
Yeah.
It's good to see him finally face it, because he's sort of just been doing this shadow campaigning where he's just paid millions and millions for TV ads.
Have you seen all the TV ads where it just like shows him handshaking Obama and embracing Obama? And
yeah.
Implying that he's got Obama's endorsement when that is not true.
No. But it was great. Yeah. Like I say, it was a roasting. He was immediately called out on stop and frisk policy.
Yeah.
You know, previous comments he's made about women and about several women who's worked for him who have NDAs against him and his company.
An unknown number of women.
Yeah. Unknown, right.
Yeah. And, which was part of the issue.
Yeah.
Like, tell us how many, Michael Bloomberg.
And it was a great immediate rebuke of the idea of having a power hungry billionaire just sort of wash his way into the Democratic contest.
And the first debate where they've actually debated?
Yeah.
Like, you know, endless debate after debate where they're just kind of agreeing with each other.
Yeah.
Because obviously if you attack somebody too hard, voters don't like that because you look nasty.
Yeah, so they're all meant to be on the same team, all hate, you know, they're all desperate to ruin each other.
Suddenly, this late in the contest, and there's still six of them on the same team. Like, shit, they're really going to get on this.
Yeah. So, in the classic opinion column analysis, who were the winners and losers?
Bloomberg was the loser.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
He just spoke poorly. He looked old and grumpy and weak, you know, he just didn't come across well on any step. And his defense for all the NDAs was, lots of women work for my company, and lots of them, and they get paid the same as men.
That's a fantastic Elizabeth Warren line. Did you hear what he said?
Yeah.
He said he was nice to some women.
Yeah. So that was very enjoyable. And Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar knocked heads.
Yeah, the long-running Pete-Amy feud, which is just kind of entirely devoid of policy substance. They just really, really hate each other.
Yeah, I never knew that there was this personal feud against them.
It's amazing. Yeah, you should watch Amy Klobuchar in solo interviews. She just rips into Pete so much.
As you were saying before, it's a classic example of a highly qualified woman being superseded by
working her way up for 30 years to become, you know, one of the most powerful people in the country, and then there's you.
this young upstart
bullshitting man that comes along and applies for the same job with no qualifications.
So I kind of I only watched the highlights, but I thought Pete Buttigieg actually, you know, the cracks were starting to show a bit with him, that he's a bit too polished and a bit too, I'd say robotic, but just a bit devoid of substance, and actually he presents over, I'm just a nice guy who wants the best, but actually he is to a sense quite egotistical. The fact he,
I think you have to be egotistical to want to
perform. I know, but it really started to shine through more.
Sure.
Before it was easier to believe that it was this kind of wonderful story that he's this young mayor who's just a really talented young guy, and just because he's young, it's his talent, and he's a great moderate, he's a great speaker, he can unite people. He's showing himself to just be a very good politician, which is the opposite of what is a good candidate.
Yes,
Now in this more cynical world,
seem to feel the need to shave, which confused a lot of commentators.
Well, you know, he's only just started growing hair, right?
Would read a long read on his decision. Really.
Yeah. So, I'm glad, and now this has happened. I think they're all going to be out for each other.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
It's
Another loser, I think, was Amy Klobuchar, who suffered from having an entire segment devoted to her inability to recall the Mexican president's name.
Yeah.
Which was not a good look.
Unfortunate, but then I think it.
And then all the other candidates leapt to Klobuchar's defense because they just didn't like Pete, and Pete was the main one attacking him.
Yeah.
It's just like nobody likes Pete.
Yeah, and like Klobuchar said, we can't all be as perfect as you, Pete.
Yeah,
and that is. I was always wondering if the Trump name for him, if he was to become the candidate, would be like Perfect Pete, and like kind of try and paint him as this kind of nerd.
Yeah,
who was wimpy nerd kid.
Yeah,
can't beat me, proper leader Trump.
I mean, I think that's elements of homophobia in that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We're talking about Trump here.
Slipping that in there. Cool, and I think with that, it's farewell, listener.
Goodbye from episode 4.
We'll see you next week.
See you later.